millions of people don't feel that government speaks for them. And when the gap between government and dissatisfied people gets too great, then you begin to have the conditions for breakdown like the 60s.
1960s, anti-war activist Tom Hayden. Today on Now I've Heard Everything, I'm Buell Thompson. Just this quick note before we get into today's episode. I've been absent from Now I've Heard Everything the past few days. My schedule interrupted, unfortunately, by some painful eye surgery. But I'm okay, so no need to worry. But here we are back again. The political turbulence of the 1960s has been well documented. And one name that appears prominently in that story is Tom Hayden. One of the founders of the Students for Democratic Society, Hayden was also a freedom writer, campaigning for civil rights in the South, but also became one of the leading young anti-war voices from the 1960s. And ultimately, in that politically tumultuous year of 1968, Tom Hayden was one of several anti-war demonstrators who were arrested at the notorious Chicago Democratic National Convention. He and those others, including Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin, were put on trial as the Chicago Seven. Now, in subsequent years, Hayden was married to another prominent anti-war activist, actress Jane Fonda, and he entered politics. Eventually, Tom Hayden became a member of the California State Assembly and the California State Senate. And in 1988, some 20 years after the Chicago Seven episode, Tom Hayden wrote a memoir called Reunion. And that's when I met him. So here now from 1988, Tom Hayden.
Reunion is, of course, a many-faceted idea. It's high school reunion. It's a reunion with my old friends in the 60s. It's a reunion with my parents. It's the turning of life cycle from childhood to adulthood. This is a book about parents and children. So reunion is a tying together of a lot of broken relationships, broken during the 60s, and finally repaired in the 80s.
Many people were broken in the 60s, weren't there, relationships and families?
It was my experience that families broke apart. The war tore people apart. In the case of my own family, my father wouldn't speak to me for some 15 years because of his unhappiness with my political beliefs and with my own activities. And he had remarried and even had a daughter who didn't know that I was her brother until we were reunited happily, quite happily, late in my father's life.
If the 60s was a time of tearing asunder, has the 80s been a time of healing?
I don't know that anything is fully healed from the 60s, but it seems to me that Vietnam veterans are getting some overdue credit for their experience. I think that they fought honorably in what I still consider to have been a lost cause. I don't think we've come to terms yet with what we've done to Vietnam. And I think that probably the dissenters are still controversial in America. We have a hard time blaming the establishment and honoring the dissenters.
Don't you think there are more, quote, mainstream Americans who now see things your way?
Oh, I think most people feel that the war was a mistake from the beginning, that we were lied to, deceived. There's some confusion about what it was all about. But it's been my observation that the people who started the war and carried it out simply went on to new jobs in the hierarchy. And those who suffered from the war, either because they dissented or because they were in the military, they got into trouble. Those people have had much harder lives since. Although I think for the most part, I think the lives are stabilizing. I think people feel they lost 5 years or they lost 10 years. the society could have been more completely torn asunder. I just can't imagine, for instance, what it would have been like in the Civil War to live in this country. Here in Washington, you see how close the lines between the Union and the Confederacy were, and you just can't imagine, you know, the two of us hating each other by reason of belief in geography and still having to live on the same soil. So the 60s were nothing like that, but probably we were torn apart more by the 60s than any generation since the Civil War.
Was that time bound to happen? Was it just a matter of time before the emotions and the circumstances exploded as they did?
Well, I dwell a lot in my book on 1968. I'm puzzled at how so much happened that year. And, you know, you try to think as an author that everything must have a reason. In fact, that's probably not so. But everything did come to a head. The military system broke down during the Tet Offensive. Our expectations about leaders collapsed as assassins killed Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King. The political system, which was supposed to be so well controlled by Lyndon Johnson, went into virtual meltdown at the time of the Democratic Convention. The international monetary system collapsed and had to be replaced for the first time since Bretton Woods. Why? I don't know. And simultaneously, there was revolt along generational lines in Mexico, in France, in West Germany, in Eastern Bloc countries, in Prague, the Russians sent in the tanks, in Warsaw. It was as if there was a generational earthquake that happened that had been building up, and all at once in that year, 1968, everything in the world was threatened and collapsed. It was incredible. And I think we're just now beginning to recover from it enough to look back. And you're seeing this year a number of books starting to dwell on the subject. Some of them are first-hand accounts. Some people have already done scholarly works, and I guess more will continue to come out.
One of the points that Todd Gitlin made, if I'm not misinterpreting his book, was that John F. Kennedy really was a catalyst. More so than if Nixon had won the White House in 1960. There might have still been some activism later, but it was really Kennedy who was the catalyst and really started the movement going. Would you agree with that assessment?
I think that the movements of the 60s really started among black students and ministers in the South. The role that John Kennedy played, however, was to, as you said, be a catalyst. He encouraged, just by his approach, he encouraged a process of change. And he also communicated the idea that it was a legitimate and a responsible thing for young people to be involved in. It wasn't anything direct, but it was the Peace Corps. It was his stance on civil rights. And looking back, I think he fostered a climate of expectations. I know that all of this happened to me at the same time in 1960. I was a student editor at the University of Michigan, and I met the students in the South who were marching and demonstrating. They had a tremendous effect on me because of their courage. I met Martin Luther King, who was at the Democratic Convention in Los Angeles on a picket line, and his very quiet courage made me feel that I should be trying to do something about the world instead of just writing about it. I had wanted to be a foreign correspondent. And then I saw Kennedy's nomination. I covered it for my Michigan paper, and that was also inspiring. Now, these are three different, seemingly different events. The Southern students were very young and tender. Martin Luther King was an older minister, just becoming a prominent national figure. John Kennedy was a U.S. senator, becoming a nominee. And yet, somehow, these things happening at once created an excitement in me, an exhilaration, a sense of at the end of apathy and the beginning of something happening in this country. And I think that was true for many, many people.
You know, I couldn't help wondering when I was reading your book how it would have been different for you had you grown up in an Eastern Wendell Willkie Republican household.
Well, I grew up in a Detroit lower middle class Irish Catholic family. I was the first to go to college and four years in college, and yet my parents really encouraged learning and ideas and books. My mother was a Stevenson Democrat. My father was a Republican who believed that Franklin Roosevelt used other people's money to carry out his fantasies of social engineering. But neither of them was political in a full-time sense. And I've had a hard time wondering what effect, if any, they had on my political thinking. I really believe that I was reacting to the vacuum of challenge, the void, the emptiness of challenge in middle-class society in the 1950s. If you were bright, ambitious, eager to do things, you saw your future as programmed and taken care of. Nothing was really interesting or exciting. I think young people tend to want to have some challenging experience, and that was the one thing that a perfect middle-class existence didn't provide.
You know, another watermark of the 60s was anger. Everyone seemed angry at something. Were you angry at anything in particular, or were you angry at all?
Well, as I look back on it, I was angry much of the time, and I was probably hurt on some deep level by my parents' rejection, particularly my father's. And I think that spilled over into a feeling that the older generation was not getting the point, particularly about Vietnam. Bob Dylan's songs said a lot about that, too. And I think that my early idealism inverted or turned inside out into a hate about 1967, 1968, capping with the death of King and Robert Kennedy. I remember I was at the cathedral where Bobby Kennedy's body came in, and I was in a honor guard at his coffin, and I went away. I think unconsciously believing that I didn't have long to live, or that I didn't have any future, that all that was also killed. And when you feel that you have no future, and that your country's intent is to jail you, or that the outcome in America is death for somebody like King or Kennedy, you have a tendency, at least I had a tendency, to be enveloped in a kind of a blind rage from then on that lasted through Chicago, through the trial, and didn't begin to fade until the early the turn of the decade of the 70s. I didn't like what I was becoming. I wanted a life. I wanted a future. And also, the country turned around, which had a healing effect on me. You had suddenly the Democratic Party, which was closed in 1968, unbelievably open to protest and change by 1972. You had Watergate resulting in the people who are trying to put us in jail going to jail themselves. I was startled because it proved that the system worked, and I wasn't ready. I wasn't ready for that. I found it hard to swallow, hard to accept. But all of that had a healing effect on me.
And now you're part of the system.
That's right. That's right.
Do you find it odd that kids of 16 and 17 and 20 consider you an old fogey who's part of the system?
Oh, I doubt that there are any young Americans out there who view me that way. I enjoy being in the state legislature. I chair the committees on labor and subcommittee on higher education, so I'm looking at the same issues from inside the system that I used to look at from the streets. And if my experience in protest and in the streets is of any value to me now, it's in the realization that millions of people don't feel that government speaks for them. And when the gap between government and dissatisfied people gets too great, then you begin to have the conditions for breakdown like the 60s. And so you need progressive, far-sighted leadership. And what I've found in the system is that there's no incentive for that. The most intelligent and able men and women are in the system. But when you have to be reelected every couple of years, and you have a tendency to vote the middle of the road, to look at the short-term issue.
Tom Hayden died in 2016. He was 76. Now you can get a copy of Reunion by Tom Hayden by tapping the link in our show notes or by going to our website, heardeverything.com. We may earn an Amazon commission if you make a purchase. HeardEverything.com is where you'll also hear my 1991 interview with someone else who was initially arrested and was actually part of what they called initially the Chicago 8 before his case was dismissed from the rest, my 1991 interview with Bobby Seale.
My philosophy was not just black power. There was a all power to all the people philosophy, and I still exist and stand on the principles of being what I call a revolutionary humanist.
And my 1994 conversation with the famous lawyer who represented the Chicago 7, William Kunstler.
Pickets around my house, bullets flying through the downstairs window, bullets in the mail, hate messages on my answering machine. If you're going to do these kind of cases, you got to anticipate and expect that and hope to live through it.
And of course, we post new episodes of Now I've Heard Everything Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and you can find us everywhere you listen to podcasts. And thank you so much for listening. Next time on Now I've Heard Everything, as the Major League Baseball season gets underway and every team on day one has a shot at the World Series, we'll revisit my 1990 interview with one of the great baseball managers of the last half of the 20th century, Dick Williams.
The tail's wagging the dog now. Players are being paid for what hopefully they will do, not what they did the previous year, but more power to the player. They have a short-lived lifespan in the major leagues. Get what you can, the owners can afford it.
That's next time on Now I've Heard Everything. I'm Bill Thompson.